Good afternoon. You're listening to Gambling with an Edge. Now here are your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today, our guest is from England. He is known as the Magician, and he is an unintentionally retired blackjack player with a very unusual story. So, Stephen Bridges, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks so much for having me. Absolutely great to be here. Really excited.
Well, wait, I want to jump in with the first question, because what does that mean, unintentionally retired?
Yeah, I was somewhat wondering that when I was asked.
Oh, well, he's been backed off of a number of places that he plays in Europe. And
oh, yes.
So,
but it's a big world out there.
So yeah, there's more of the world out there for sure.
Well, let's start there. Are you retired from blackjack, or do you intend to keep playing?
I guess currently I'm on forced vacation. Although now international travel is opening up a little bit more, I actually now, I can think about going to the US again. But for a long period of time, obviously, due to the coronavirus, traveling has not been an option. And then, yeah, in Europe, the games aren't amazing. So I'm backed off from any local game that I would want to play. So, yeah, I've been limited in what I can play in the past year, which has been a shame because I was just hitting my stride with really getting into the world of card counting. But now things are a little bit trickier.
So let's go back to the beginning and how you got started in this. And we should tell the people right off the bat that you decided to document this journey and turn it into a YouTube series. So why don't you tell us how that all began?
So I am a magician by trade. And as part of that, I have a YouTube channel where I perform magic tricks. And I've also been a street performer professionally. And on my YouTube channel, I documented that process of getting into the world of street performing, which actually does share some weird parallels with AP work in terms of conflict and variance and things like that. So I documented that journey and I was aware of card counting. This is all a bit of a blur to me, but I kind of thought of the series as a great excuse to learn to count cards and a real motivator if I was also making a series about it. And also I thought at the time I hadn't seen many documentaries that had shown a brand new player, someone just learning and going through that process. And I also hadn't seen anything that had sort of shot it in a bit of a more YouTube-y format that was a bit less produced than documentary. So I just thought, this would be an awesome journey to go on and to document. So I got in touch with Colin Jones and asked him, hey, I'm interested in doing this. Is there any way we could work together? Because at the time, I didn't have a bankroll. I didn't have much money or anything like that. So I was hoping that I could somehow work with him a bit and learn and then document it. And that's
now,
what ended up happening.
How did you know who Colin was?
Yeah, great question. And it's, as I say, it's all a weird blur. But I guess I'd seen the movie 21. And at the time, I thought, especially in the UK, everywhere is CSMs, right? You can get a shoe game occasionally, but they're kind of hard to find. And I thought, oh, these machines exist. That means that they're going to be everywhere eventually. Card counting is going to be done. That's sort of it. But then I came across Colin's videos, I think, or the website, I came across something. He's pretty much everywhere when you search for card counting. And that gave me a bit more faith that it still existed and was still a viable thing. And then he was the person that I thought to get in touch with, as he, you know, has a membership program and everything like that. And I thought, as well, I thought the audience demographic that I have on YouTube are probably the kind of people that are in the right sort of, yeah, the right demographic that might be interested in his stuff. So I thought there might be a mutually beneficial relationship there if I got in touch with him.
And was your initial thought, like, I can make money card counting? Or was your initial thought more about, I can create a really interesting docuseries?
Yeah. Well, it was a few angles at once. I mean, firstly, if I'm being totally honest, I just really want to make sure that at the end of my life, I look back and I think, all these cool things I considered doing, I actually went through with a decent amount of them. So as soon as I heard about the idea of card counting, it really appealed to me. So it was a really great way of ensuring that I had to do it. If I'm documenting it, I've got extra skin in the game because I'm producing a series. But I also thought it would make a really cool series. So there was so much of it that appealed to me that I just thought I had to try it and capture it on video.
Had you ever made any kind of docuseries before? I know you shot yourself doing magic, but had you done any kind of docuseries before?
Yeah, not really. The closest thing I'd had is these street performer videos where I just one day, the way I got into street performing was that one day I just realized I was totally broke and I had to pay rent in 6 days and I had no money in my bank account and I was actually like in a bit of sort of overdraft debt. So I had no money and I thought the only thing that I can do right now that guarantees that I can get paid on the day is try street performing. And I had the magic skills to go and give it a go. So then I called up a cameraman friend of mine and I went, come and film me doing this because it A, gave me that extra accountability. And also I thought I might as well see if there's a video in it. And then I got really deep into street performing, ended up really loving it and filmed, I guess, sort of on-off series, not much of a through line or anything like that, not much of an ending, but just documenting my journey of getting the hang of street performing. So that's the only thing close, but I guess this series is a little bit more documentary-esque, maybe a little bit higher production value, despite it all just being me with a camera and a hidden camera filming it myself and editing it myself.
Right. So yeah, you didn't have anybody with you filming. You filmed like in the other, like if you see Colin's videos in the casino, there's somebody else filming him or one of his teammates or Casey, his documentary Inside the Edge, there's somebody else doing the filming. And now, did you have any experience with going, hidden cameras and all of that kind of,
nope.
I mean, you had to think to yourself, okay, if I want to film in the casino, which I think is really like a brilliant idea. I love the fact that you went in and filmed in the casinos, but.
Brilliant and scary.
But scary, yes, yeah, terrifying. Yeah. I mean, knowing what it's like to go into a casino with hidden equipment, like, that's scary because if you get caught, even if – I don't know if you're technically breaking any law. I don't think you are, but that doesn't mean you may not end up in jail.
Yeah, I guess I should be very careful on the legal questions. I will say that – yeah, so firstly, it was really terrifying. I have no – experience with hidden camera stuff. I don't have any experience in, you know, producing content beyond from an amateur perspective that I somehow kind of turned into a job at some point. So I don't really have a great deal of training on using cameras. So with the hidden cameras, as you're right, I needed a hidden camera and I knew I was going to film it myself because of budget restraints. I couldn't hire a camera guy or even get a friend to and pay for the flights from England and the accommodation in America and all this stuff. I just couldn't afford to have somebody else with me. I had to do it all myself. So I bought a bunch of hidden cameras at once. And the guy that I bought them from ran like a spy shop. And he said I could buy them all and send back the ones I didn't like. And I got to test them all. And using a watch camera was really the best case scenario because it felt like the least, it was the most normal looking item. And also, if I wore like a hidden camera that was attached to a button on a shirt, that's like wearing a wire. If they see you with that, it's very clearly something dodgy. Whereas at least a watch that has a camera built in felt a little bit more covert. And it's also the thing I felt I could angle the most. So I did a lot of standing with my arms folded in the casino, which during back offs as I'm filming them must have made me look very hostile and kind of a bit aggressive in my defensive stance. But I found that worked really well. But the thing which worried me the most, other than knowing I was walking into a casino and some tribal casinos, you know, I've read the Law for Gamblers, if that's the correct title, and things like that. But I don't know what's going to happen if I'm in a tribal casino. In honesty, American police don't have the best reputation in the UK in terms of the, like, it feels a bit, you know, your police have guns. The whole thing is just a bit higher stakes than what we're used to here in the UK. So, and the legalities of filming are a really tricky one. You can make the argument very solidly that what I'm doing falls under like a journalistic intent. And a lot of what I'm trying to capture is, in a way, exposing casinos and giving an insight into how they actually operate. I'm sure that you guys have seen this and other people listening have seen this, but when you go in a casino, one time, the person that I'm on the table, the only other blackjack player, was so unbelievably drunk. I've never seen someone not be able to stack up their chips because they were so drunk, and they were playing, not even putting their chips in the right spot, not knowing what they were doing, playing blackjack hands. And I sort of gave the dealer a bit of a look and went, is he okay? And the dealer was like, ah, it's fine, and shrugged it off really casually. Of course, because this guy was tipping the dealer every hand, but had no idea what was going on. And then I get backed off from that casino minutes later, and it's just that weird double standard. So part of it, I'd say, you know, there's a bit of journalistic integrity. Not that I'm a journalist, but I'm certainly trying to show an inside view of what casinos are like, which I feel gives it some legal defense. However, that's not necessarily how they're going to see it. And legal cases are complicated, and I'm not a lawyer. And there are laws in different states and countries about recording conversations without both party consent that, you know, I didn't realize a lot of this stuff early on. But the one thing which really worried me about the watch was that it heated up when it was recording. And I have no idea what surveillance capabilities they have. I didn't know if they could detect heat. I don't know how prominent that technology is, but if they could, they'd see my wrist lighting up hotter than anything else around because it was filming. So that was one of the things I was most worried about when going in to the casino for the first time. Also, the watch would flash LEDs when you start recording, which is the silliest feature for a hidden camera, but so I'd have to turn it on under the table or under my sleeve. So I was worried about the camera a lot, but yeah,
how much,
I didn't get caught with the camera.
How much time would it hold?
Yeah, it would record for about an hour, I think, an hour and 15, and that would be it done. So I had two watches. I bought two of the same so that I could sort of rotate between them if I needed. And I would just climb in my car and get my MacBook out and plug them in to sort of charge and take the footage off and things like that. But
oh,
yeah,
so they weren't
the
connected to a separate battery of some sort.
I wish. Hidden camera technology is... it's either pretty behind. I mean, there mustn't be a massive market for it, which I'm sort of glad of. There's not many like morally acceptable reasons to sort of secretly film. But yeah, it seems to be quite tricky to find one that's like well balanced. I would happily pay a large amount of money for a hidden camera that was on my wrist, but good quality and could film for hours and hours. But yeah, I had to juggle two watches and turning it on and off when I thought something interesting was about to happen. Lots of just a couple minutes of nothing happening because I felt like I was about to get a back off, and I really wanted to capture all the back offs I could.
Go ahead, Bob.
Before you actually started the filming process, you amazingly and surprisingly got an instant bankroll.
Yes, this is ludicrous.
Which is a fascinating story. I kind of wish that had happened to me one day, but tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is obviously the most interesting thing that was going on in my life. As I think, I know most APs will keep it quite hidden and they might tell some friends, but in general, I was telling people what I was up to, especially considering it was all really taking place abroad. So it felt like England was quite a safe place to discuss this stuff amongst friends. So one time I just had a friend of mine that was helping me move house, and we were in the moving van about an hour and a half drive. And he was just asking me so many questions about how it all worked, just really interested. And I was answering. And then he just dropped me a text a little bit later saying that he wanted to invest because we talked about how that works. And not, never me pitching him at any point. And he just said that he wanted to invest £20,000, which I was like, wow, that solves my bankroll problem. I'll have like money. I can make this work. And then a few days or weeks later, he dropped me another text offering £200,000. And it was just ridiculous. And I will say, I can't really mention right now too much about the money, but I think it's good to know the way that I pitch it in the series, the way that I mention the money, it almost implies that my friend is this really rich guy that has millions in the bank and this 200K is no big deal. And I had to say it like that in the series to protect his identity and things like that. But in reality, if he'd lost that 200 grand, it would have absolutely destroyed his life. It wasn't, you know, you're supposed to gamble with money you can afford to lose. This is a high risk situation.
It would have been awful. I wouldn't have been able to take it from him. I mean, maybe half of it, so that if you lost it, at least he's not, you know, devastated, right? Or whatever. But man, I mean, did you try to explain how crazy that was for him to want to invest that much?
Yes. Yeah, I did. Well, this is where it comes down to me having a bit of a misunderstanding of N0 at the time, which is still a concept I find so confusing. I have to look at it visualized to really like take it in properly. But I thought, foolishly, after one N0, you were guaranteed to be in profit. So this is a big mistake. And I explained this to him, and he even looked up some videos on N0 and also misunderstood it. So we didn't perceive the risk to be nearly as high as it actually was. So if I wasn't so naive, and this, I guess, is testament to why if you get a massive bankroll, you shouldn't start playing at those stakes if you're a beginner, because you don't know what you don't know at that stage. So,
well, the other thing is, if you know, a lot of the intent of all this was to make the docuseries, you don't need to have a 200. You could easily do the docuseries with a $50,000 bankroll, right? I mean, and the other thing is, what was your plan if you didn't have this $250,000 drop in your lap? Like,
sometimes you've just got to take the first step and really commit and hope the other things will line up. So,
I mean, was your bankroll going to be $10,000 or something if this guy hadn't showed up? Or
my bankroll was probably going to be $0 if he hadn't showed up. So I think what my plan was, because of working as a YouTuber, quote unquote, you often get paid to promote a product. I would do a magic trick involving a product, and that might pay a decent amount of money. So I was thinking of basically using that as a bankroll. I wasn't sure if Colin wanted to invest, or I wasn't really sure. I was just open to options, and I just hoped it would figure itself out. Yeah, really. I mean, this is excellently highlighting how insane this whole plan was. But as I said, at the time of getting into card counting, I didn't even have, you know, really enough disposable income to just join BJA, you know? So it's like, at the time, really a weird thing for me to be getting interested in. But luckily it came together and I got a bankroll that was naive enough to accept, and I didn't lose it. So
now you get this bankroll, and the next step is to fly to the States and take a blackjack boot camp?
Yeah, so this was before I had the bankroll. I took the boot camp, and I've been, you know, learning. I think I had I could do basic and keep the running count and true count conversion. My deck estimation was a bit shoddy, didn't have any deviations down, and I went to boot camp. But then boot camp was amazing. It wasn't till about 11 months later when I actually had properly planned a trip to go to the States, to go to Washington State for a month. That was mainly just because of a bit of a lack of organization on my part, and just trying to sort of juggle so many plates, keep so many plates spinning in my life at the time. I had to run my YouTube channel, also keep doing street shows and these other projects, that it was hard to dedicate all the time that I needed to card counting. So I was both a bit slower than the average person at learning, because it just took me a while to get the hang of it, and also because I hadn't put enough time in. So it was 11 months later, and not too long before actually going to Washington did the bankroll thing all come together. But yeah, then it was me with £200,000 wondering how on earth I was even logistically going to work with that much money, like taking money across the border, converting the currency, having the cash. I just didn't know. Yeah, it was all.
What did you do?
That's a great question. So my first plan was, we were figuring out, we realized that I couldn't just take $200,000 or $250,000 in a duffel bag over to the US. Nor did we want to convert. Yeah, right. Nor
well,
did we
you
want
could.
To convert.
There were just some risks.
Yeah, they'd probably ask some questions. I wasn't looking forward to that. But also, we wanted to avoid converting the currency until we needed to, because otherwise we're going to eat exchange rates and all that stuff. So I went to a bank in the UK called HSBC that I found also have a branch in Seattle. And I tried to get them to, well, I did get them to make me a premier customer, which I just did by going, look, I'm wealthy. Here's 70 grand in my account that my mate had transferred. And they upgraded me to a premier customer. And I opened an account. And that would give me a US dollar balance. Now, I thought and I was hoping that that meant I could stick a bunch of dollars in that balance, go to the US and then withdraw them. But they wouldn't let me do that. I actually had to go to the US and open a bank account there at the HSBC, which they might not have let me done. So, and also just getting the dollars was a nightmare. I remember one time, I'm not sure if it was just before this trip or not, I'd pre-arranged with the bank I wanted to pick up $10,000 or something to that effect. And I called them up several times to check it would be there. And I got there. And of course, they didn't have the money. And in the end, they had to give me these sort of tourist packets that were wrapped in plastic. And you got two $1 bills, two $5 bills, two $10 bills.
Oh, my God.
And things like that. A couple hundred. And I just had to get a stack of these packets, 10 grand's worth of these packets, sit in the bank and unwrap them from the shrink wrap and have all this brand new crisp bills, but just in this horrible combination of denominations. So it was the messiest process with money. But I can't remember if that was on the first trip or on a later trip. But either way, in the end, I took over $10,000 to Washington State and then managed to open that HSBC account. And that was my backup plan. I could have money transferred and then arrange to have a large cash withdrawal. But luckily, I didn't need to dip below my $10,000 in that time that I was in the US.
But you were betting pretty large stakes for a $10,000 bankroll.
Yeah, in terms of, I guess, trip risk, it was quite high. I think because of Washington State, the table maxes at the tribal casinos top out at about $500. So I think I was doing two spots of 450 as my top bet to avoid the whole, you know, announcements from the dealers and stuff. But yeah,
so you could easily lose that in a session.
Yes.
But I mean, you said you didn't, you started out betting. I mean, you didn't start out right away betting 2x450, right? Your first time in the casino counting cards.
Yeah. What Colin instructed me to do and advise, because I went to Washington and met up with Colin and had a test out there where my game was good enough, is how I would describe it. Where I was under no illusions that my game was perfect, and now I have a sort of an app. Now, you know, at the time you just don't know what you don't know, and now I kind of know what I didn't know, and I can look back on some of these videos and think, wow, you were so naive then. I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but there's one time in a video where I lose $1,000 in a session or something, and I so arrogantly in the car talking to the camera tell the camera how it hurts to lose the money, but I'm starting to get used to the swings, as if I knew what a swing was. Much later on, I've now experienced losing, you know, $25,000 in a session or something, and I didn't know what pain was at the time, but I thought I did. So yeah, all this to say that I was obviously quite naive at the time, but I got my game tested out by Colin, and I think it was, what was any, did I make mistakes? I maybe had one running count mistake, being off by one. I think I counted a nine and then went, no, I shouldn't have counted the nine, but I hadn't even counted it at first. And then a couple of other minor things. But he assessed that my game was a winning game. And then I played about 15 hours in a few casinos, just at the lowest stakes possible, to just get used to that environment, because wow, it's scary to walk into a casino for the first time and know that you're doing something that they don't like, and it feels a bit like you're committing a crime.
Were you filming that? My heart would break. Those first sessions?
Yeah, I was. I was filming. I mean, I wasn't expecting a back off because of my spread being so like non-existent. But yeah, I was filming bits and pieces all the time. It was that balance where I had about 2 hours of recording capability per day ish. So I was trying to not film every single second, but yeah, I was filming and playing and getting used to it. After that time, Colin had somebody else. I don't know if they use their name publicly. Loudon Offen is what they go by. Who was on the church team, test me out in the casino. So he came along and just, it was the quietest casino. It was the Caribbean in Washington. It's just this small card room. And it was just me at the blackjack table, and him stood behind me, whipping out a notepad and making notes on my game, which I just thought was so bold of him to do. And yeah, so he tested me out in the casino and asked me like the odd question so I could pass him the count, one of which was asking me how many bananas I thought I could fit in my mouth, which was, and he obviously asked it on a running 20 or something insanely high just to make it really awkward. But he assessed that my game was good. That gave me a lot more confidence. And at that point, I spoke to my investor, who I was in frequent contact with, always giving him, I was very honest with him every step of the way about every bit of the process. I wanted to make sure that he really understood. And I felt the risk of his bankroll like a lot. Like I knew that it was money that couldn't be, we didn't want to lose. And he just was so much, put your foot on the gas. Bet as big as we can do. Our risk of ruin is really low because of a 200K, so just go for it. And I was like, do we not want to find a bit of a midpoint between two hands of $500 and and just a, you know, a couple of $10 bets? But he really wanted me to go for it. And all the way through, especially back in Europe when the table limits were higher, he just was go for it. Just bet as much as you can. He just saw it as, this thing works. The concept scales beautifully. Scale it now. Let's make a load of money. And that was his approach.
So on this trip, starting out in Seattle, you stayed in the States about a month, I think you said. Did you get down to Vegas? Did you go anywhere other than Washington? Where else did you play? And how good were you at the end of the trip?
I mainly stayed in, well, I completely stayed in Washington. My strategy was getting an Airbnb. I think I started off in North Washington, so that I got an Airbnb there only for a couple of weeks so that I could hit all the casinos in that sort of region. And then I got one in the South to sort of hit the ones in the South. So I just found that, you know, luckily for me, I had enough casinos to play until my last sort of few days was when I was running out of casinos. But even then, when I had to catch my flight back to the UK, I hadn't been backed off from every casino. So yeah, for me, I just hit all of the casinos I possibly could in Washington, one of which I absolutely loved was really, really North Washington, quite close to Canada. Drove for ages to get there. And it was almost like what I would call an English pub in the vibe. It was this tiny, little place where it just looked homemade. It just was, I didn't know you could have a casino in that casual a format. And the dealers were the fastest dealers I'd ever seen. And they were watching TV whilst dealing. The whole atmosphere was so strange. And I won there and I felt weirdly guilty for the first time ever counting cards, because it felt like a tiny business that I'd taken money from. I mean, I don't quite feel that. I mean, they were perfectly happy to take my money if I'd lost, but it did feel really strange. So in general, I started off, my strategy was to play the casinos that I knew didn't database. And I was very scared of getting an OSN or anything like that. And I'd been given a list of casinos to avoid. So I started off with all those first and then progressed on to the OSN casinos, where I inevitably got databased and they got a lovely picture of my rental car and my face and things like that, which made things a bit trickier. But luckily, I didn't lose too much momentum. And yeah, to answer your other question, Bob, I got much better by the end of the trip. After those first 15 hours of just playing at small stakes, a lot of the anxiety and stress of just being in the casino and all that had worn off entirely. So then it became easier for me to sort of play better. And I think my game improved massively in that time.
All right. This is a good place to stop and have a few commercials. We'll come back and we'll find out how blackjack is different in Europe than it is in the United States. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In December, the main part of the month, December 13th through the 23rd, is 50% off on almost everything. Bars, restaurants, hotels, gift shop, liquor stores, bingo, New Year's Eve, events, spawn, salon, showroom, movies, bowling. for the first 12 days during the rodeo, play 1,000 points, and you can earn a bottle of moonshine. These are differently labeled bottles than what they had during the NASCAR. These are holiday bottles, and you can do one a day, and you keep your points. It's when they were had this promotion earlier, the moonshine, if you go for the original, it's a full 82 proof. If you get one of the flavored versions, it's only 80 proof. The on December 13, earn 600 points, and you get a threesome of Yankee candles, which are jars with wax in it and a wick, and quite attractive.
Hey, this is Colin from Blackjack Apprenticeship, and if you're serious about card counting, I'm sure Bob and Richard would agree that there are three things every Advantage player needs to succeed. You need to gain the edge over the house, you need to manage your bankroll, and you need to get the hours in at the casinos. After a decade of playing professionally and running teams, I wanted to create the exact training, tools, and community I wished I had had for myself and my Blackjack teams, so we created the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership. Our membership will help you perfect your game, manage your bankroll, and you'll join a supportive community of like-minded card counters and APs. Find out more at blackjackapprenticeship.com.
At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Magic Deal Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where periodically prior to the deal, you receive one, two, or three magic deal cards. These are like wild cards, except they are determined after the other cards are dealt, and they must take the value of a real card, which means you cannot have a five of a kind in a game like Double Double Bonus. The frequency of the magic deal cards depends on the game. On games where two pair receives even money, which is basically jacks or better and bonus poker, you get On games where two pair receives even money, which are highly volatile games where four aces pay a lot, you get relatively few magic deal pokers. On games where two pair receives double money, this is jacks or better and bonus poker, you get significantly more magic deal cards simply because they don't do you as much good. All right, we are back with Stephen Bridges. He had a successful trip to the United States where he got tested out by some people at Blackjack Apprenticeship, spent a month cleaning out Washington Casino successfully.
How successful? So how many hours did you get in that first month and how much did you win?
I luckily have opened up my Excel spreadsheet because people, when I'm asked this, I just forget off the top of my head. So in Washington, I have all the lovely stats. I played 112 hours, or near enough 113. And I had 25 winning sessions, 21 losing sessions, and my overall says that it seems slightly higher than I thought. It says overall $25,000 up at that moment. I feel like it was shorter. So maybe that's slightly off for some reason. But yeah, I walked away in profit, which I was very happy about. I maybe should have been even happier about it now understanding N0 and how I could have so easily with that time period got away crying and on a massive loss. But yeah, was in profit in that kind of range. I don't know why, but I remember it being more around 16,000. But it says here some wins.
Maybe in pounds instead of dollars. Maybe that's what you were thinking.
Yeah, I might be. I could quite possibly be reading my own data wrong. But you, either way, you get the sort of range.
Right, your investor must be like, oh my God, bet five times as much, right? I mean, he must have been thrilled. Yeah. But I will say that is a pretty good amount of hours for only 1 month. That's You were out there grinding.
Yeah, I mean, what else was I going to do? I didn't know anyone else. I had nothing else I could do. So, no exploring the sites, really. I think I spent one day in Seattle just having a little look around the town and drinking a very expensive but delightful coffee. But other than that, yeah, just hitting the casinos as much as I could.
Okay, so now you're back in Europe. How are the blackjack games different in Europe than they are in the United States?
Oh, they're so... I shouldn't be too pessimistic about them because I have played them. But there are a few really major differences. And I often see on blackjack forums in general that US players tend to have a sort of different idea about how Europe's going to be. And it really requires a different strategy. So other than there being so many CSMs, that's just ridiculous. Sometimes you have to ask for a hand shuffle game. So if a place has got CSMs, they might give you a hand shuffle game at around, I don't know, 30 euros a hand as a minimum, or maybe £25 or something like that. So there are very few games that you could find. I think I know of one game in the whole of the UK that has a £5 minimum. One game, I think, that you could play. Maybe there's two. So really, you've got to be playing slightly higher as your minimum, which is a pain. But in general, what's common in the UK and Europe is terrible pen, really bad, sometimes two decks, two and a half decks cut off sometimes. And bear in mind, you've got to go in this place, ask if they'll open a table because they don't do a hand shuffle normally. They then spend, oh yeah, in 20 minutes, we've got Bob coming and he'll, from this member of staff, he'll open the table. And then you wait 20 minutes, they open the table. They then spend an unbelievable amount of time hand shuffling the cards. And then you get ready to play and they put the cut card in right in the middle. And it's just the most frustrating thing. So a lot of the time, the quality of the games is worse. You've got stand 17, but there is no hole card. So that changes the strategy a little bit and affects things. I think it works out about the same sort of, you know, EV or quality of game as a hit 17 game in the US. The stand 17 and the no hole card sort of cancel each other out. But the big problem that I found, and this is so bad in the UK, but it's also a thing in Europe too, depending on where you go, is our gambling commission or gaming commission is really good for the players. And they're really concerned about players getting gambling problems or money laundering. So they will fine casinos millions if they don't adequately vet their players. So unlike the US, where you can walk in, whip out a massive stack of cash, sit down, nobody asks any questions, and you can play for hours. In the UK, and it's different at every casino, but once you've bought in for a certain amount of money, they'll stop you playing and then need to see financial statements. And you cannot keep playing until you've shown where the money come from. And then they have to then dictate that you can afford to gamble at that level, right? So they've got an expected loss that you'll make. You know, they can see their EV off you. So if you're coming in and betting, you know, two hands of 800 euros or whatever it's going to be, after a while, they're going to project that you're going to lose a lot of money. So then you need to be earning loads of money for them to justify that you could have that gambling habit. Not only that, I'm yet to find a casino in the UK that I could play without having to join and play rated. And all the casinos tend to be networked. There's not many independents. So once I got backed off from one, I got backed off from about a third of all of the casinos in the country because you need a player's card to even go in. So in general, half of the game I find in Europe is figuring out how I can legally bypass those financial checks or trying to figure out where their thresholds are and get around that. So just that whole other element of it makes it really annoying. The one benefit, though, the one great benefit from the UK is that gambling is not taxable. It's not a proper job. I couldn't be taxed on it if I tried. They wouldn't let me, which has, you know, a blessing and a curse, but we don't have to pay taxes on winnings, which is nice.
So that's UK. What about the rest of the continent?
But I keep sort of overlapping them a bit because the sort of same things operate a lot in the rest of Europe too. So generally, one of the worst things is just really bad penetration, which just ruins the games anyway. So that's the main problem that you'll come across, as well as really low limits and also just CSMs everywhere. So a lot of scouting just to find the hand shuffle game. And even if you call up the casino and somehow ask if they have a hand shuffle without that being particularly suspicious, I've had times when I've gone in and they haven't had one. So after that, imagine making a trip, even if it's a short flight, to go to the one casino that you think has the hand shuffle in that country to get there and it be CSN. So frustrating. So a lot of it is that, which is just very, very bleak. And I mean, I have an AP friend that's just gone to a country in Europe. I guess I can say where it is. He's just gone to Poland, and he just was like, strike this off your list. I couldn't find a game that was worth playing. And he went for the sole purpose of counting. He just couldn't get a good game.
So I would think you would want to go back to the States, right? After running around Europe with these terrible games. So is that what you did next, or?
Yeah, so I networked and met some other European card counters, and we just decided to do a massive Las Vegas team trip. Excuse me, just because we thought this'll be fun. My investor was keen to just stick his whole 200k bankroll into this team trip, and then other players and invested as well. So we ended up with a bankroll that was close to $500,000 for us to play in Vegas, and our top bets being in the region, I don't know if they want me to say specifics, but you know, two hands of 1,000-1,500 kind of range, which is obviously not a small amount of money. So the high limit.
Well, but for a 500 bankroll, that's not unreasonable. I mean,
yeah. So I mean, it was an extra level of just the weirdest feeling when you go out and you're betting that much money. I can't help but think of it in terms of my rent, you know, and how many rents I'm losing or winning at any given time. I know a lot of APs can just switch off a bit to the money and chips are just plastic, but for me, I still felt it a lot of the time. So we went over as a team, and we were mainly playing just as individuals, all sharing a bankroll, which was an absolute blast, and I loved that experience. We had a nice upswing of about $97,000 in maybe 3 days or something, which was awesome. But then over the next few days, we lost all that money and then hit a negative, which was incredibly painful, as you can imagine. We also dabbled a bit in the traditional sort of BP team play style and had a shoe where I signaled in the BP and he lost $30,000. This was already when we were sort of on a bit of a losing streak after having been at such a high, which was incredibly painful. And then we flew to a different state as we were sort of getting a bit low on Las Vegas options and started, the idea being we were going to properly do the BP team play stuff. And that's why we picked this state. There was a lot of, you know, lots of tables and stuff. But this is exactly when the coronavirus started really hitting its stride. So this was the first time I'd heard the term social distancing was in a casino. They said, oh, we can only have three players at this blackjack table. Yet over to my right, the craps table is just packed with people. And it's just like, why? What is this double standard? I just didn't like the consistency of it. So that really ruined our whole team play experience in that respect. And we just did the best we could to sort of play. The whole US trip, Vegas and that other state, we ended up basically breaking even when you take into account expenses, which was a bit of a bummer given how we had such a massive high at one point. But this left us all itching to do team play properly and not feeling like we'd really had a good go at it. And we just kind of liked that camaraderie of playing on a team. So fast forward quite a lot of time later, a year or so, and I've been playing a little bit in Europe here and there when it was possible to travel on and off as the UK would open and close its coronavirus restrictions. And a friend of mine, the Irish AP, he called me up and was just telling me about this casino he was playing in Europe, which I was like, oh, wow, that's actually really good. They've got more than one blackjack table that's a hand shuffle and they're cutting off around about a deck. That's great. And I thought that was really cool. And then it occurred to me, oh, this could be quite a good... We could maybe do this BP stuff that we really wanted to do. So I called up Ultimate, who's another card counter friend that's just a really good person, but also manager, just really good at all of the crunching the numbers and the CVCX and all that stuff. And in the end, four of us decided to go to this casino and do this team play strat. The whole thing was, once again, making a trip for one casino. So catching a flight to go play at one casino, which we knew had these financial restrictions about how much you could buy in for and things like that, despite the fact, as far as I remember, they had no table max written down and that the sort of bottom bet was like €5. So it was the perfect kind of spotter situation. And we had our BP had been sort of vetted by the casino. They thought, yeah, he's wealthy enough. And we all met up in an Airbnb and trained for sort of a couple of days solid. We came up with a way of signaling, which didn't require any verbal communication, because in Europe, they're allowed to record the conversations at the table and listen to them. So surveillance could listen in on what's being said, which I don't believe is allowed in the US at all. So we thought, if we're just playing this one casino and we're really going to burn it down, we're going to play until they kick us out because we have no other options. We thought we have to have a really robust communication system. So we came up with a strategy that just involved communicating what the betting unit should be and then whether or not to go with basic strategy or deviate from basic strategy. So really quite a simple system, but it was really deceptive. And we played that in this casino. So we all go in and we sort of join up as members at different times, coming in an hour later or on different days to join. And we played for about 7 hours until the casino got close to closing time. And only in the last hour did we start getting a bit of heat, which is very obvious when you've got a BP that's flashing the cash and spending loads of money. They're being really nice to casino staff. Just cannot pretend to do that. It's so hard for them. If they think he's doing something sneaky, they absolutely cannot keep that level of friendliness without it being so obvious. So they were being a bit cold. I saw someone's ID on one of the screens and I thought, oh, that looks like a UK driver's license. That's probably one of us. We all sort of had a bit of a panic chat on the WhatsApp group about whether we should go because we thought maybe we were about to get backed off. We were also worried about them withholding our money because in Europe, it's just a bit of a free-for-all. I mean, I'm sure you all know that the story with Phil Ivey and the AP situation he had.
We've had card counters on the show where they just stole their money in UK. And they said,
right?
These casinos are private clubs. It's against the rules to count cards. We're keeping your money. You broke the rules.
It's crazy. And in Belfast, there was if I remember correctly, there was a roulette player who wasn't an AP that didn't get his winnings. And it was a huge amount of money because private business don't need to. Absolutely insane. So, I mean, we were worried about just that. And maybe they would not cash us out. So there was a lot of panicked conversations on the WhatsApp group, which, as a side note, I think is why it's really good to have, even in a fairly informal relationship, it's really good to have a team manager or someone that gets final say, because you never want to have an argument at the time. You want to talk through every option before it happens, but you don't know what's going to pop up when you're actually on the day. Some things might just happen and you need someone that's going to make that decision and then you all just have to go with it. So that was kind of useful, but we played until closing time. And then the next day we sort of sent the spotters in. We were taking side bets about whether or not we'd be backed off, and each one of us they had got. And the way that they'd caught us was basically because we'd all joined the casino recently. And they had that data. They could see, oh, these players that were in that night, they'd all joined within the past week, except the BP. So that's how they caught us. I ended up having a chat with one of the managers and breaking one of the sort of golden rules of being an AP and just admitting to him that we were counting, because I we were all banned. We weren't going to get any time. And I thought I could get some useful information. So managed to chat with him a while, and he told us basically how they caught us. And that was the main thing, which was good to know. But we got 3 times our EV. I think we made about 40,000 euros, or I don't know what that would be in dollars, around about that kind of range. So we were so happy. They thought we were doing some advanced multi-level count because of how good our variance was. But that was great. Yeah, we just had an absolute blast.
Before we run out of time, I just want to ask, did you ever have any really bad backoffs, especially that may have gotten caught on camera?
Yes. So I had in a tribal casino in Washington, there was a situation where they tapped me on the shoulder and they asked to see my ID. And I knew that I didn't have to give my ID and I didn't want to. And I was also aware that I was filming. So in a weird way, I kind of I'm okay with a bit of conflict because I'm shooting a docu-vlog series. I just was like, I'll stand my ground. But they got so aggressive so fast and just being like, are you going to show us your ID or are you going to get out? And I was like, do I need to show you my ID? And the guy said, yes. And I went, why? It's the law. I'm like, what law is it? My law. Because that's what I've said. And it's just this horribly, it's just this aggressive dude. And also, you know, an unnecessary amount of, you know, when it's just too many staff members around, really intimidating. And I kept saying, I just want to take my chips and, sorry, I just want to cash out and leave. And they were saying, you're basically trespassing for being here. I'm saying, you're holding me here because you won't give me my money. They then said, we're going to call the police. So they called the police, and it's a tribal casino. So I'm bricking it because I think, what if these police, they're paid for by the casino? Are they going to? So I'm slowly walking to the door whilst calling up loud and often and asking him for advice when the police eventually get there and sit me down. And I talk through everything. The craziest thing is I said that I was counting, and they said, well, you're not playing on a team, are you? As if that would make a legal difference. But they said that. So weird. And eventually they escorted me to the cash desk, and as soon as I got my money, I essentially ran out of the casino because I didn't want to get a trespass. And I sort of talked this through with the cops. I said, if I get my money, can I just leave? And they went, well, you could. I was like, I'm gonna run out of the casino at the end. So I basically sprinted out and managed to get my money. So that was one of the worst ones that I had, just because of the hostility. A couple of other situations where they just wouldn't cash me out, and I just really insisted, and eventually they did. And yeah, so those are the most unpleasant times, normally at tribal casinos, but not always. But I think that's probably just because they're bigger establishments. But some really, when they're trying to make you feel scared, is the situation which I really resent, because I'm trying to have a very calm conversation and they weren't having any of it.
Now, if people want to see your videos, how do they find you on YouTube?
Yeah, all you need to do is go to youtube.com/Stephen Bridges. Stephen is spelt with a V. Bridges is spelt like one bridge, but more of them. So Stephen Bridges, you should be able to find it. The series is called Beat the Odds, but I'm pretty easy to Google. So if you go on youtube.com/Stephen Bridges, it's there.
And we should mention that the whole docu-series is not out yet. You're releasing like one a week or something like that.
Yes. So. Yeah.
Very good. We could have extended this interview for quite a bit longer. We appreciate the time you gave us. It was interesting, and we have not had a guest quite like you before.
Well, so, thanks so much for having me. I've been listening to this podcast when driving around the state, so it's nice to be. It's an honor to be here, so I appreciate it.
Very good. At the end of our show, we have a recommended by the hosts sometimes and the guests sometimes. Richard, is this one of the sometimes for you?
No, I got nothing today.
All right. I'm going to recommend a novel called Dead Irish by John Lescroart, Lescroart. Lescroart has written dozens of books about San Francisco crimes and lawsuits, featuring a lot of recurring characters, including Dismas Hardy, who's a former cop, former lawyer, currently a bartender in this book, who's now trying to leave it all behind. Abe Glitzky, who is a half-black homicide cop who gets promoted as the series goes along with Private Eyes and Private Investigators and several others, recurring characters. I've read maybe half of them. Dead Irish is the first Dismas Hardy book, and I had not previously read it, and it might be his best, or one of his best anyway. If you're going to start reading this author, many of whose books are on audio tapes, making perfect for long drives between casinos, I recommend you start at the beginning. Here, for example, I already knew Hardy and Glitzky would survive whatever perils they were in, and this book introduces Hardy's future wife, although they aren't a couple by the book's end. If you read books in order, they're a lot more suspenseful because you just don't know what's going to happen down the road. But whether you read this one before or after the others, Dead Irish is a good book. So, Stephen Bridges, do you have a recommended you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I think this is something that will hopefully appeal to this audience. It's an app that I've been using. It's on every platform. It's called Anki, and it's an app that it's essentially a flashcards app to help you remember stuff, but it uses an algorithm so that it only shows you cards when it thinks you're nearly going to forget them. So it's just the most efficient way I found of memorizing random bits of info. So you can use it to put your deviations in or different chart options. Or as I'm using it right now, I use it to just learn the capitals of different countries and where they are on the map. So I find it really useful. You spend 10 minutes a day on it and it just helps you become smarter and memorize basically anything you want to memorize in the most efficient way possible.
How do you spell this?
It's A-N-K-I.
And we'll put a link to it in the show notes. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. All right. So thank you, Stephen Bridges. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.